Accession number 27460, Reel 7.
Mr. Wilkes, Reel 7. You were talking about your time down at Southampton.
Yes. So we remained in this rest camp overnight and most of next day. And then eventually we were taken down to the docks, and we drivers and people, we were loaded onto a ship called the Prince Boudouin. And we remained on that ship until it sailed. And it was late-ish on in the evening. I remember dusk was coming in as we set sail, and we sailed to Brest.
At this point, can I just intercede? How did you feel about going to abroad? And of course, the Germans were pretty well winning at this point in time.
They certainly were, yes.
But what were your feelings?
Well, my own feelings was that we're going to do something for them, because now we were given to understand we were going to try and hold a defence line, do a fighting withdrawal for the troops that weren't actually trapped at Dunkirk but were behind the Germans. So we were going to try and help to extricate those.
You had no fears that you might get yourself caught yourself, you know, trapped yourself?
Quite honestly, I didn't have any fear at that stage at all. I felt I was a soldier, I was doing what I had to do, and I was going to do it.
So the adrenaline was flowing, you might say.
Yes. And I remember on the ship there, these 6th Cameronians, they were on the front end of the ship. And as dawn broke, we were amazed. They were there sharpening their bayonets. And we thought, well, you know, this is war, we're going into it. And so as we approached Brest, there were quite a lot of fishermen, Breton fishermen, and they were waving to us and acknowledging us as the ship slowly came into port. We got off the ship, and then we had to march up to a temporary camp. It seemed uphill all the way. And we were ready for something to eat, because it was about 24 hours since we'd eaten.
Have you any idea what date this would be?
Round about the 9th or 10th of June. We might have sailed on the 9th and got there on the 10th, or we might have sailed early and got on here on the 9th.
Had you, by this point, did you know that Dunkirk had been evacuated? Was that information available to you?
Well, at that stage, we weren't sure whether it had been evacuated or was still ongoing.
Because you hadn't got this information, that's told
right.
You.
Well, in those days, it didn't seem as though we used to get much information from the officers, and that it was all sort of
American term.
Came to us. So we went up, and as we went into this camp, we were given a tin of McConaughey stew, and we had to open it and toss it into this cauldron and get it heated up, and you'd get it back later warmed up, which we did. We slept out in the open that night, and the next morning we were marched back down to the docks. The city of Florence had arrived in then with our vehicles, and we went down onto the dockside, and then it was a case of waiting till they all came out. So when we got down onto the docks, we were given some information. We were given a map reference to where we had to make once we got our vehicles. And the same young man that was riding with me when we went through Whitney Weir was still riding with me at this point. I don't know what his duties were, really, but there he was. So we sat on the dockside waiting for our vehicle to come off. We saw different ones coming off. And then the sergeant came to me and he said, when you get your vehicle, you have to go along the dock and pick up 80 rounds of ammunition. So I said to him, well, I said, I'll have to unload all the camouflage nets, otherwise I'll be top heavy. Oh, he said, you won't have time for that. He said, you'll just have to manage. He said, but when we get to the rendezvous tonight, he said, we'll see that you get unloaded and properly loaded. Okay, I thought. And then he came along and we were told we had to make to another point before we went there to the rendezvous. We had to go and collect petrol for 300 miles. Every fifth vehicle had to pick up a 5-gallon drum of oil, and every tenth vehicle had to pick up also a 5-gallon drum of gear oil. So who dropped unlucky? I had both engine and gear oil. So we eventually, my vehicle came off and we went, picked up the ammunition, which made the vehicle very unstable. And it was wallowing about, and we made our way up to the depot, this place on the roadside, Royal Army Service Corps. They had a big petrol dump and oil dump, and they had these rollers that they could put the tins of petrol on. Now, the tins of petrol were packed, 2 4-gallon drums, cans I should say, in a cardboard carton with a piece of wire around them. So you had 8 gallons of petrol each time, and so I got my allocation of petrol plus 2 drums of oil piled on top, and away we went. And we got to our rendezvous for the night. It had been an interesting journey along here, because the French people turned out in their hospitality, and we had been given a chip full of strawberries. And it just happened that we had a tin of carnation milk with us, so we were sitting there dipping these strawberries in the can of carnation milk as we drove along, enjoying ourselves.
And the vehicle itself, was it extremely difficult to handle on the journey?
Yes,
on the journey?
Yes, it was. It rolled about. It was very unstable. So we finally got to our rendezvous for the night, and we were pulled in such tight lines there was no way we could get it unloaded, and I was just told to grin and bear it. So the next day we set off, and we were approaching a French town called Laval. And bearing in mind that you always, when you're driving in France, give way to vehicles coming onto your road from the right. So we were travelling along this road just a few miles before we got to Laval, and there was a farm situated on a bit of high ground to the right, and this old man came down on a bicycle straight out in front of me, straight across the road, backed out into the middle of the road and swung back in. Well, there was a vehicle coming in the opposite direction, so I had to swerve to avoid the cyclist, and then as I swerved back in to avoid the oncoming vehicle, the padlock on the back petrol can rack of my vehicle caught this man's boiler suit pocket and split his boiler suit right down to the bottom and threw him off his bike. Of course I stopped, and in a moment I thought I had a hostile crowd around me, but they were all talking and jabbering away, and it turned out all they wanted was an apology. Now, we did have a French liaison officer with us who came and put the matter to rights, and so I thought the matter was over now. I apologised, and I suppose it was the fellow's own fault, but I felt equally guilty. So, anyway, when we got to Laval, the vehicles, we came up onto this T-junction, and our vehicles were all parked along this lovely avenue of trees, and we couldn't, as I came up, I couldn't see a parking place, and I was diverted down a little farm track. And I went down into a farmyard, turned round like one or two others, and came back up so far, and we had to remain in this sunken track. And we were on quite a steep slope, still with my load, and as soon as I reported in, I was put under open arrest. So I thought, you know, things get better. Anyway, it turned out I was only under open arrest until the following day. The French liaison officer explained in detail what had happened, and I wasn't going to be done for dangerous driving or anything like that. And so that was that. But during the night, German bombers had been across. And they must have known we were somewhere in the locality, but further along this avenue of trees, there were a lot of refugees. And I understand we heard bombs dropping, and I think they got the worst of it. And we were lying in the back of this wagon on a slope, and I know my feet were against the tailboard. We'd slid back on all these ammunition boxes. We'd slithered down and we couldn't get any further down, and we remained there. However, we had breakfast, and all the vehicles that were along this avenue, everyone had to take turns and sitting on the cab roofs with your rifle. And we didn't have many rifles, because if my memory serves me right, the complement of rifles for a battery was 18.
That was, I think you said that was just for guard duties.
That's right, yes.
Had you come across refugees before this stop?
No.
Were there any on the roads at all?
I think there might have been. I couldn't swear to it. I think there might have been. But this was an awful sight.
You actually see what had happened to them yourself?
Well, we could only imagine, because the bombing had stopped and people were trying to sort themselves out.
So it was bringing war really home to you?
Yes. So we remained at Laval till the late afternoon. And then we moved out of Laval and we travelled to a little village called Mont-Saint-Jean. And there, as soon as we got in, the quartermaster grabbed me. He said, right. He said, get your vehicle unloaded. I thought, thank heavens. He says, we're going to a petrol dump to get some petrol. So it at least got my load off, a bit of assistance to get it off, and we went for petrol. And we came back and put the petrol into a pit for safety.
And this was usual, was it?
Oh, yes.
It was built in with your training, did you?
Yes.
Was it again an RASC dump that you went to for petrol?
I think it would be. I think it would. And of course, a lot of the tins weren't still in the cardboard cartons. And some that were, I think they'd probably been bombed or something, and a lot of tins were leaking.
I think this was a fault with the British fuel tins at that time.
Yes.
Before the jerry can was
kind of. That's right.
Which they got from the Germans.
Yeah. Because the tin was very thin tin. Disposable, really, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So, I always remember getting back there. Now, we'd been issued at some time previously with a tin, like a large sardine tin, and it had some chocolate in, and it was in four big squares, and you weren't supposed to have any of this until you'd been without food for 48 hours. So somebody must have come across a spare tin, and in the billet he was brewing up some cocoa made with these blocks of chocolate, and it was delicious, very acceptable.
What food did you carry with you on your person? Did you carry food on your person?
No.
On these journeys?
No. We only had this chocolate. We had a field dressing. I think those were the only things we had officially, but we had one or two things unofficially that we'd acquired.
I was thinking in terms of, for want of a better term, iron rations, you know, emergency rations.
No, this chocolate was the emergency ration. Now then, at this stage, we were at this Mont-Saint-Jean for a few days. My vehicle was parked down in an orchard. And I fell in love with little Mont-Saint-Jean. There was something about it. And anyway, I know there was a lot of refugees started coming through Mont-Saint-Jean this night. And I know I'd bought some bread up in the village, some of these French sticks. And there was this family coming along, and they spoke English. I think they were English. The two girls and their mother. I think they'd be in their early 20s, these girls and the mother. And they said they'd been on the road and hadn't had food, and so I gave them this half stick of bread that I had. Someone else gave them some either corned beef or some sardine or something. But they weren't long in going, but we did put some petrol in their car for them. We were giving petrol to refugees to keep them moving.
Was this a spontaneous thing, or were you allowed to do it? Dad, you asked for permission to do it.
Well, from memory, I can't remember exactly, but I think we were just giving it. I think we had some spare petrol, so we were dishing it out.
The sight must have been quite an effect upon you, these people.
Yes, people travelling in those circumstances. Yes. It was heartbreaking, really.
Did it strengthen your resolve?
I suppose it did, with no intention of giving in anyway. So, anyway, I was told this particular night that I had to go and sleep beside my vehicle. Now, bear in mind, it had been reloaded, the 80 rounds of ammunition and the camouflage nets, which was quite a big bulky load. I was told that I had to sleep beside my vehicle if we were called upon to move before 0400 hours. I was to report immediately to the battery office. At 3:45, I was told to be prepared to move, so I drove round to the battery office, and there we loaded all the battery office equipment onto the top of my unwieldy load. Amongst them was a box. It was all ordnance and survey maps. The box would be round about a metre square and possibly, 15 inches deep. So you can imagine all these maps pressed in. It was a tremendous weight. Somebody said it was 300 weights. It took a lot of us to lift it onto the back of the lorry. And then the chap that had been riding with me, he had to join the rest of the battery office staff and ride in the back. And permanent staff instructor, Sergeant Major Bunn, he would ride in the cab with me. At 4:10, we started moving that morning, and we continued to move all day long. We did hear of attacks. Our quartermaster had stopped. I know we went into a wood where we thought we were going to rendezvous prior to the guns going into action. But I think the Germans had beat us to it. So we started then to move, and we continued moving all day long. And at 1:10 in the morning, we finally pulled into a field outside Cherbourg. I was absolutely exhausted. No food all day. And so the quartermaster, who'd been a bit in front of us, word got round, he was, because he was a great fellow, a Somerset man, and he would help the cooks to get these men a hot meal.
Do you remember his name?
Mead, M-E-A-D, Sergeant Major Mead, Quartermaster Sergeant Mead, yes. He would make a meal, but I was too exhausted. Making my way back from the cookhouse, or what was to be the cookhouse, I walked into an animal. It was a bull in the middle of the field. It wasn't tethered or anything. Of course, I got such a fright, and when I discovered it was a bull, I thought this could spell trouble. So I made my way back to the cookhouse in the blackout, and so they got the farmer out of bed and got him to shift the bull. So that was that.
Had you known at any point in time where you're going and where you were heading? Did you think you were going towards the Germans or pulling away?
No, I personally didn't know where the devil we were going.
And for such a long journey, how did you keep awake?
Well, I didn't actually. My vehicle actually clocked 321 miles that day. Now, not long before we got to where we were staying the night, I just couldn't keep awake any longer. And the Sergeant Major said that one of the office crew could drive. and they put him in the driver's seat, and the next I knew I was back out again. I had to, but that few minutes rest did me a world of good, and I drove the vehicle into the harbour for the night.
And you would know at that point that hopefully you're going to get back home.
No, because we even then still thought that we were going to engage the enemy. So next morning I was asleep in my cab when I was rudely awakened by someone opening the door telling me there was a bombing raid going on, and the bombs were dropping not very far away. So breakfast was served shortly after, and I was delighted to be able to eat. And then I'm not sure if it was a sergeant or a sergeant major came round and said we had to be prepared to wreck all our equipment. We were going to have to abandon it, and it would be every man for himself. And as the talk went, we were to make our way down to the docks and try and get fishing boats or whatever we could to get home.
This must have been quite a shock to you, a surprise.
It was, yes, it was. And I didn't think it was really going to happen. I couldn't see it happening. However, about an hour later, that order was countermanded. But in the meantime, I had been instructed to try and destroy this case full of maps. The damn things wouldn't burn. The linen-backed maps, they just don't. Anyway, that's beside the point. About an hour after we'd been told to be prepared, we were told that a ship had managed to get into the harbour, into the dock, and they were going to try and save the guns. Now, there were 24 of our guns and 24 from our sister regiment, the 71st, and they would take the guns down to the docks, four at a time, and I can't tell you what the interval between travelling down was, but the guns would go down four at a time. So, having nothing better to do, I got a haircut. We had a chap who was a hairdresser, and he cut my hair while we were waiting. And we were still a bit apprehensive whether it would work out or whether we'd have to try and escape. Anyway, when all the guns had got safely down to the docks, then they started taking the rest of the vehicles in order of priority, eight at a time down to the docks. And my vehicle was in the last eight that would leave this position. And Sergeant Major Bunn would ride with me. And we got so far along the road, and we'd heard a lot about fifth columnists, but now we thought we were going to meet them. These Frenchmen blocked the road, came across the road, and I said to Sergeant Major Bunn, "What do I do, drive straight through them, or..." "No, no," he said, "we'd better see what they have to say." Well, they were all excited, and it was for a good cause. The Germans must have cut the road in front of us. And their pigeon English and my schoolboy French and the help of a map, we plotted a route that got us safely down to Cherbourg docks, not a shot being fired. We got there unscathed. So when we got to the docks, this was the heartbreaking part. Everyone was ordered out of my truck, and I was told to go and park it, and the Royal Engineers would blow it up. And so I said, "Right, oh, I'd park it." And then I made my way across. There were two gangplanks at the front end of the ship, and I suppose possibly two at the aft end. But these two gangplanks, it turned out, one was for going up onto the ship, the other for coming down, because so many French people, children as well, they were trying to get onto this ship. And the rails at each side of the gangplank, if they could push either a child or themselves through and get between two soldiers, they would get conveyed up to the deck. But there were both civil and military police at the bottom and the same at the top. So when they got to the top, the civilians, children as well, were sent back down the other gangplank.
That must have been a heart-rending situation.
It was, yes. So I made my way across the ship. I had to get across. We were getting on the starboard side. We had to get across onto the port side. And as I'm walking across the hatch down to the into the hold, what did I see but my vehicle being loaded? And there wasn't anywhere for it to go, but it was just plunked down on top of some others, and that's where it remained. And the hatches were battened down. So I got away round to the other side of the ship, and I was chopped in between, I think it was Cameronians again, and our ship cast off at 10 minutes to 10 that night, and we sailed for Southampton. We learnt later that a ship full of refugee children had been sunk in the harbour that afternoon, and our ship made our way to Southampton. We knew the destroyers were escorting us because we could hear them with a whoop, 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 whoop all night long. But we couldn't sit down or anything. We were packed in so tight. And it was 11 o'clock next morning when we finally docked in Southampton. Glad to get off.
And your feelings at that point?
A feeling of despair. Wondering what on earth would happen. And we got off the ship and were taken once again to the rest camp.